Next up, we have Ellery Shemp. I am really excited to hear him talk. He has been an ardent supporter of the ACLU and defender of the separation of church and state. And what makes me really grateful for him is that while my parents and grandparents were pushing the opposite direction, pushing for more religious influence in the public sphere, it makes me grateful to know that the America we live in today is a better place because of things that he's done. I mean, at just 16 years old, you probably have heard about this, that he staged a protest against school requirement for Bible reading and the Lord's Prayer, and that went all the way up to the Supreme Court in 1963. A lot of the freedoms that we have today are because of the fight that people like Ellery Shemp have done in the past. Yes, absolutely. Give him a hand. But as you all know, that fight is not over today. It's still going on. And so let's give it up again one more time for Ellery, and let's listen to him talk.
Thank you. Well, thank you for that very nice introduction. You didn't happen to mention that I was born in 1940. Once. I got born only once. My mother was actually there, and she saw no need for me to be born again. And I also will note that one reason I'm here is that I'm older than most of you. I'm living proof that oldness does not mean retreat from the values of separation of church and state. And trust me, oldness will come to you too someday. Sometimes I start by saying, "Let us pray." I usually wait for nervous giggles. So it's an interesting, I pray for continued separation of church and state. But that's an interesting point about what we pray for. I can tell you that as a 16-year-old, and you can use your imaginations about what I might have been praying for. This is a problem prayer that is rarely discussed. Well, I must say that in all my talks and meetings over the years, I have never been part of such a distinguished panel of free thinkers and thoughtful speakers. I find it wonderful to be part of this wonderful community. Well, I've been around in separation of church and state issues for more than 57 years. In fact, next year will be the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court case, Abington versus Shemp and Murray versus Curlett, which was decided in June of 1963. More about that in a few moments. Some of the previous speakers mentioned that the McCarthy era, which was at its height in 1956 and earlier in 54, and the phrase "under God" was added to the pledge in 1954. And in keeping with last night's theme, I might remind you that Playboy magazine started in 1955. So it was in 1956, when I was 16 years old, that the idea of that the Bible reading and Lord's Prayer practices in the Pennsylvania public schools was a major violation. The idea of separation of church and state goes back many centuries, and there have been many struggles. One was in Transylvania, of all places, where King Janos Sigmund held a debate, and David Ferenc, representing the Unitarian viewpoint as opposed to the Trinitarian one, he won. This was in 1590. For the very first time in history, a king granted freedom of religion to his subjects. This decision was unparalleled in contemporary Europe, where the state recognition of the Unitarianism had been where it was impossible to think about a state recognition of Unitarianism, and this was the beginning of religious tolerance, which was kind of the beginning of the separation of church and state. The problem is that church institutions grew up alongside state institutions, governmental institutions, and they were always in conflict over power. Power, we know where that comes from. Money, influence, police power, judgments, and prisons. In every time, churches have tried to seize the power of government to obtain control. They have an obvious objective. Their wealth and loyalty is in contest with the power of the state. And it's an important thing to remember that church leaders do not have to be elected by the people. Let's jump ahead to the American Constitution, ratified in 1781. Let me tell you, there is nothing in the Constitution about the Bible, and there is nothing in the Bible about democracy or our Constitution. Our Constitution never mentions God or Christianity or any commandments. It is a purely humanistic document. The preamble begins, as you all know, "We the people do ordain and establish." Our Constitution mentions religion just twice, and both times the word "no" is attached. The first mention is in Article 6. No religious test shall be required to hold public office. And the second time is in the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The Constitution is a religiously neutral, secular, and political document. No founding father thought the idea of an independent judiciary or three branches of government came from divine revelation. Note that the Declaration of Independence, and I'm covering some material that has already been mentioned, but I want to emphasize it, refers to our inalienable rights endowed by our Creator. But this is not any part of U.S. law. This language was intended to counter the so-called divine right of kings, and the Declaration of Independence has no legal standing whatsoever. It's a very important point to remember. Now, by contrast, the Bible never mentions democracy, a republic, or anything related to American values. The Bible never once mentions freedom of speech, or freedom of religion, or elections, or anything related to democratic freedoms and values. The Bible provides no model for good government or for personal freedoms. It is a purely religious and theological document. So it seems to me that Bible reading and prayer in the schools do not promote American civic or patriotic values at all. Now, jumping ahead to 1962 and 63, many of you already know my story. I was a teenager in Pennsylvania in Abington Township, a suburb of Philadelphia, and I objected to our morning devotions, where 10 verses of the Holy Bible were read, followed by the Lord's Prayer, every morning in every school classroom in the state of Pennsylvania. And yes, this exercise was called morning devotions by the public school system. I thought this violated the principle of separation of church and state, and in particular, violated the Establishment Clause. So with the support of my parents, Ed and Sidney Shemp, and most vitally the ACLU, we challenged this law, and we won a decision in the United States Supreme Court in 1963. We won 8-1. Now, you remember all of the decisions. So you all know that recently the court is so closely divided that a 5-4 victory is the best you can hope for in many, many cases. There's an excellent, so if you didn't pray in school, it was because of this. And I want to mention that there's an excellent account of how the legal developments occurred, and it's given in Stephen Solomon's book, which he has entitled Ellery's Protest. I didn't write it, and I didn't choose the title, but I noticed that FFRS has several copies of it out there, and I really can tell you that it's very, very well written and researched. We also must remember Madeline Mary O'Hare in talking about our case, because the full name of the case is Abington versus Shemp and Murray versus Curlett. Now, that was the title assigned by the Supreme Court. Over time, of course, it became truncated to Abington or Shemp. And there are some who persist in describing it as some kind of vast conspiracy to rob Murray of her rightful recognition. I have never done this. I knew Madeline Murray, and I respected her. No one can deny that Murray was an important figure in making atheism visible, particularly by founding the Organization of American Atheists. As to how the case got named in this order, no one seems to be able to say. I've even written to some Supreme Court clerks from that era, and their guess is that it had to do with the timing. Indeed, the Shemp case was filed in 1958, and the first hearing took place in Philadelphia District Court on August 5, 1958. I recall it very well. It happened to be my birthday. Madeline's case was filed in 1960, 2 years later, in Baltimore. Owing to different lower court histories, the two cases reached the Supreme Court at the same time in 1962. The Supreme Court joined, or consolidated them, to render one decision for both cases, as both were presented substantially the same issues. So for Madeline Murray's legacy, I say these two things. She and her two young boys suffered horribly in Baltimore. She was reviled not just as an atheist, but as a woman atheist. Women are and were supposed to be the repository of religious faith and morality. So her sin was kind of double. I do know that in order to escape the persecution and animosity in Baltimore, she fled to my parents in suburban Philadelphia and stayed a weekend where we gave her sanctuary. Very sadly, in 1996, Madeline, her son, and granddaughter were brutally murdered by a past employee motivated by a theft, which went terribly wrong. I'm one of the few remaining who can speak of her to her legacy from personal remembrances. So I thus speak here today not on behalf of not only Madeline, but also all of the other pioneers in separation of church and state. Now, there are libraries of books on these issues, so I can only discuss a few of them in this short time. There are, you won't be surprised to learn, a very long list of cases that have won different battles to uphold the separation of church and state. And these battles go back more than 75 years. One important one was the Everson versus Board of Education in New Jersey case that was decided in 1947. And this is the first case which established that the 14th Amendment required that the Establishment Clause, and in fact, indeed, all of the Bill of Rights, had to be made binding on the states. The important phrase was that due to the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, and it is surprising, I think, to many people, that the First Amendment did not originally apply to the states. So the 14th Amendment was a critical decision coming from Everson that across the board, the non-establishment rights applied to all states and indeed to all local governments as well. In 1948, there was the McCollum case. And by the way, there's a book called The Lord Is Not on Trial by Daniel McCollum, who was a young man, his boy in 1948. In Illinois, there was a practice known as release time, in which priests and preachers were brought into the school and kids were expected to join one of the classes during the school time, but released from the normal school studies in order to meet with these. And of course, there was no provision whatsoever for non-believers. In 1962, there was the go back to the Torcaso case in 1961. It's the only case I know of that was decided on the basis of the no religious test that's in the Article 6 of the Constitution. Torcaso had applied to be a notary public in the state of Maryland and was required to sign an oath saying that he had a belief in God or he wouldn't be granted a notary public license. Such a high-level license, of course. And he sued on the basis of no religious test and won in 1961. In 1962, there was a famous Engle versus Fatale case that had to do with a New York Board of Regents prayer. The state of New York, in its wisdom, had formed a committee of people to write an extremely innocuous prayer to the effect that, Almighty God, we ask your blessings upon us and our teachers and our country today, amen, something like that. But that was declared unconstitutional in 1962 with a very memorable phrase, it is no part of the business of government to be composing prayers. Well, the Abington and Murray case that was decided in 1963, our main objection was over the Bible reading, which is actually required by state law, but incidentally, the practice of the Lord's Prayer, which is not required by law, was also declared unconstitutional. Obviously, if composing prayers is unconstitutional, selecting prayers must be equally unconstitutional. Well, Andy, Laurie, and others have already mentioned the Griswold case having to do with contraceptives. There's the very famous case by Alton Lemon, having to do with tax money for parochial schools, and this has resulted in a so-called Lemon test, a three-pronged test to decide whether a law that somehow involves religion is constitutional based upon whether its primary purpose was to foster religion. And the details of this are very complicated, but I urge you to read up about the Lemon case. And then Debbie Weissman in 1991 won a case in Providence, Rhode Island that applied essentially the Engle and Abington cases to graduation prayers. And there have been many others having to do with school football game prayers. And then, of course, there's many group of evolution cases. Just a few of these are the Epperson family versus Arkansas in 1968, which invalidated an Arkansas statute that prohibited the teaching of evolution. The court held that the statute was unconstitutional because the Constitution does not permit a state to require that teaching and learning must be tailored to the principles or prohibitions of any particular religious sect or doctrine. Edward versus Aguillard in 1987 declared unconstitutional Louisiana's Creationism Act, which was required that creationism be taught alongside of evolution, and the court held that the provision of a comprehensive science education is undermined when it is forbidden to teach evolution except when creation science is also taught. And then there is, of course, the many people in the Kitzmiller versus Dover area having to do with intelligent design decided in only in 2005, a very beautiful decision, and it's been mentioned several times, but I urge you to go online and read the entire decision. It is fantastic. And I cannot do justice to all of the separation of church and state cases in these few minutes, but I mention these names also because they are not just abstractions. They are and were real people. I wish we could all spend a moment to think about the personal fortitude and the sacrifice and hardship that each one of these people endured. These were individuals who were standing alone with a lonely voice and sometimes threatened with personal harm. Parents taking on the wrath of the community to protect their children from injustices, and children facing ostracism and losing a normal childhood. These were the great heroes of separation of church and state. And I give credit to the justices who considered and wrote opinions. I am forever amazed by the quality of opinions that are written, even those I disagree with. And the lawyers who wrote the briefs and argued the cases, they get far too little credit. In the case of our case of Shemp, our lawyer Henry Sawyer served pro bono for the ACLU and spent a year researching and thinking. It's a damn shame that the case is not known as Sawyer, and similarly with the other cases. Well, from this remarkable era, Vashti McCollum, Roy Torcaso, Madeline Murray, my parents, Edward and Sydney, have all died. Steve Engel was elderly. I'm about the only living person who knew all of them. It should be noted that Pennsylvania has had more than its fair share of important court cases. Abington, of course, Lemon comes from Philadelphia, Allegheny County having to do with the nativity scene, and the Dover case that I just mentioned, the wonderful decision about intelligent design. This is because Pennsylvania consists of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, with Alabama in between. And to give credit to Rhode Island, part of the Lemons challenge was to a Rhode Island law about taxpayer money going to Catholic parochial schools. And Debbie Weissman brought her case about graduation prayers in Providence, Rhode Island. And we all know about Jessica Alquist. As a little side note, it was Roger Williams in Rhode Island who first wrote about a garden wall separating the beauty of government, democratic government, from the faith of religion. It was from him that Thomas Jefferson came up with the phrase of a wall of separation of church and state. For 200 years or so, it was common practice in most schools to have some sort of Bible reading and prayer in the morning. These morning devotions arose out of our history. After all, the idea of universal education was a relatively new idea that took firm root in the era of the Enlightenment, around the time of 1776 up to 1820 or so. The idea that being educated, that is being able to read and write, having some knowledge about nature, knowing something about the wider world outside one's own village, that was a radical idea when applied to the common man. Knowledge is power, they say. They also say God is love, although I think love is love and complicated enough without getting a God mixed up in it. In school many years ago, I thought the notion of reading about Noah's flood under the imprimatur and authority of a state-sponsored devotion and then going to geology or biology class was and is deeply offensive to my scientific sensibilities. We all know that Noah's flood never happened. I do not believe in miracles or supernatural interventions in human affairs, and I thought it was wrong for the schools to teach them. I disbelieve in talking snakes, too, or at least I used to, but then Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin came along. Of course, in school, no power on earth or heaven can prevent a student from offering up a silent prayer before taking an algebra exam. However, I always urge that doing the homework and studying is far better preparation than prayer. Our family received about 5,000 letters, roughly one-third supporting us, one-third opposing in what we might say are reasonable terms, and one-third, as you can well imagine, hateful and vituperative. Many of the letters in support actually quoted the Bible, Matthew chapter 6, where it warns about praying for public display as the hypocrites do, and seeking public approval, and not to use vain repetitions. My parents answered every letter that had a return address. This was in the days before Xerox machines, and when stamps cost 3.5 cents. But it still came to hundreds of dollars. We were accused of being everything the writer hated. So the natural letters are, what are you, commies? What are you, Nazis? What are you, Jews? You expect that. What are you, Catholics? Well, that wasn't, but we didn't expect the ones that said, what are you, Methodists? Then there were the amusing ones that said, in the name of Christ, go to hell. Some were newspaper pictures smeared with excrement. I don't recall any letter that accusingly asked, what are you, Zoroastrians? I conclude that nobody hates Zoroastrians, and you might want to look into it. One of the things we learned was that in the United States, it was considered bad not to be Christian. It was very bad to be a communist. But it was really quite awful to be an atheist. When people called us, you communist atheists, they had reached their ultimate in outrage. Atheists are the most hated and feared group in America. Fear and hate often go hand in hand. For myself, I always thought that if there was ever a time that prayer was surely needed, it was when getting a driver's license or entering a shopping mall. And to show that I'm just not just an out-of-date fogey, I now pray quite earnestly whenever I encounter a driver texting on a cell phone. The First Amendment is clear. There shall be no intertwining of government and religion. But you can have all the personal beliefs you want. You can believe in psychics, magnetic bracelets, in Zeus or Jupiter, in Venus or Aphrodite, fairies and pixies, praying and rituals, all to your heart's content. But you have no right to get any government to help you impose your views on the rest of us. I oppose the view that praying and searching for spiritual peace or healing is a satisfactory substitute for learning about difficult issues in the world and struggling with them. I think our struggle is not to find inner peace, but to keep alive the itch that makes us want to do better. As the poet John Donne observed, there is peace in the grave, but none, I think, do there embrace. Public prayer is not intended to promote religious values, but to enhance the authority of some churches and some political views over others. Similarly with the posting of the Ten Commandments. It is about power, not about religion. And the Constitution clearly intends that there should be freedom from religion. Government is to be free from religious interference. This is quite clear because the Constitution makes no provision for any church or religion to have any official role. Our Constitution and our government do not depend on any divine blessing. We got many letters about what I call the missionary position. Many people who protested the Supreme Court's decision said, well, if it weren't for prayers in the schools, many kids would never hear about Christ or God. Well, what an absurd idea. But so what? What is the source of this notion that everybody has to be introduced to Christ or to Allah in order that their souls might be saved? I think if believers are happy with their souls, they can leave mine alone. The right to privacy, to be left alone by government and police, is an important constitutional liberty and derives in part from separation of church and state. The school attorneys argued at length that Bible reading was vital to instilling moral values. They even went so far with this as to claim that the Bible was not a religious book. But what about these moral values? Well, I note that when Catholics and Protestants talk about morality, they actually mean just sex. But no writer in biblical times had the slightest clue about sperm or ova or genetics. Did you know that the human egg was only discovered in 1827 in Russia in St. Petersburg? After all, as has been pointed out before, it is religious dogma that opposes gay marriage and the rights of women. It was religious dogma that made contraception illegal. It is religious dogma that promotes circumcision and genital mutilation. It is religious dogma that promotes abstinence and categorizes masturbation as sin. 100 years ago, it was religious dogma that insisted that women were morally unfit to vote. And of course, it's religious doctrine that aims to discredit evolution and insert intelligent design in schools in place of sound science. The Ten Commandments, and incidentally, someone mentioned, and I should mention, that there are actually 613 commandments in the Bible, and you can actually discover this by the simple trick of typing in 613 commandments into Google, and they all come up. Well, the Ten Commandments, as has been pointed out, the first five are about a God belief and have no moral or ethical content at all. And I do not see the Ten Commandments as showing the slightest concern for children or family values, nor for freedom of conscience. Our laws are clearly based on economic capitalism and humanistic values. I mean, is there seriously anyone who thinks our tax laws and Medicare laws are based on commandments? Moreover, religion by rote does not promote spiritual values, nor does constant repetition of the pledge promote patriotic or civic values. Public prayer is not intended to promote religious values, but to enhance the authority of some churches and some political views over others. Seems to me that monotheism has not produced any observable benefits. In the old days, if the rain god or crop god or fertility god didn't do right, you knew exactly who to complain to. Now you have to complain about the whole universe, from global warming to bank bailouts to Acorn community organizing, just to get your foot in the door. And there is a very good case for polytheism. If you have 365 gods, then every day is a holiday. In our Constitution, the word in the First Amendment is religion, no law respecting an establishment of religion. The phrase, interestingly, is not a religion, but religious doctrines or dogmas in general, which are prohibited from being established by governments. This is an important distinction. Non-establishment is broader than merely one church or ecclesiastical organization. The founders were thoughtful men, and they did not choose the word religion over church without careful thought as to its meaning. And Madison noted throughout history, superstition, bigotry, and persecution have accompanied the union of religion and government. He also noted that Christianity did not need the support of government to flourish. This is an important point to remember when somebody shouts out about original intent. Owing to Tom Paine and the general intellectual movement of the times, the Enlightenment, and the distaste for existing systems, the founders reached back to ancient Greece, a pagan civilization, for inspiration about democracy and a government based on the common man. Having discarded the divine right notion, they had no intention of allowing a new set of religious doctrines to take over. The divine right of kings notion had prevailed from the earliest days of Christianity and arose from earlier pagan philosophy that rulers, by virtue of their being rulers, were obviously favored by the gods. This divine right notion not only gave kings legitimacy in the eyes of the church, but allowed that whatever religion the king had, everybody else had to have too. Kings loved the idea, of course. Almost all the language in the Declaration of Independence is to refute church authority in rulership. This is where we see inalienable rights granted by the Creator to ordinary humans, disputing the supposed superiority of the kingship class that had been supported by the church. The Declaration of Independence is equally for independence in both government and in religion. It had to be so. Divorcing the king meant divorcing the king's religious authority. The Declaration of Independence was not based on the Bible or the commandments, as has been pointed out earlier. In fact, it was in direct opposition to churches and religious hierarchies. There is not a single phrase in the Bible that offers a model for the Declaration of Independence. For the colonies to declare independence in direct violation of the king was indeed a radical step. The divine right notion was deeply embedded in everybody's mind, in priestly leadership, and in political thinking before this time. The authors of the Declaration needed poetic language and appeals to emotion to overcome the divine right mindset and to reject the notion that we needed a blessing from the Almighty in order to prosper. One of the most brilliant ideas of the founders, probably James Madison, was the idea of an independent judicial branch. This, too, was a radical departure from the European systems the founders were aware of. Under the divine right notion and the hegemony of the church, there were actually two different court systems, the normal civil and criminal courts under the king, but also church courts. Church courts dealt with cases of heresy and blasphemy, as well as clerical conduct. There were no checks and balances on these courts at all. This issue was revisited just a few years ago when the Catholic Church in Boston had the chutzpah to actually argue in court that our courts had no power over priests and that priests could be judged only by the church's canon law courts. This self-serving position was summarily rejected by the U.S. federal courts, a ratification that constitutional law trumps church law. People sometimes say, of course, that we are a Christian nation. We are not. We are a constitutional nation. It is, of course, entirely true that the majority of Americans self-identify with some brand of Christianity, but our Constitution, our laws, our governments are not Christian. They're not Jewish or Muslim or Buddhist either. And look how successful separation of church and state has proven to be. The United States has more churchgoers, more denominations, and more money donated to churches than any other country in the world. All the evidence shows that the secular constitution has been extremely good for religiosity and religiousness. Today, there are loud voices claiming that Christians are being persecuted and their beliefs are under threat of extinction. I cannot take them seriously. When I drive down the street, almost every corner has a church with a prominently displayed cross. It is absurd to think that Christians are an endangered species. I do note that churches always have lightning rods. This shows a lack of confidence. Well, in fact, the Christian right are thriving, and they're flush with political power, and they have huge amounts of money, and they claim to speak for all Americans. But are they using this power to promote tolerance and good government policies, decent conditions for our citizens? Sadly, often not. They are exercised about posting the Ten Commandments, having more public prayer, getting tax money for religious schools, denying gays the right to marry, prohibiting abortion, and insisting on keeping under God and the pledge. I think people turn to gods when their own situations are unhappy or confused. If there is fear for the future and little joy, then a promised reward in an afterlife begins to look more attractive. Unfortunately, pandering to public piety has always appealed to politicians, but I very much oppose the politically motivated God talk. Many of our fellow Americans seem to feel vague fears and seek refuge in the supernatural for a naive sense of security by displays of religiosity. The role of separation of church and state is all the more important, and because it does government no good to rely on magical thinking, and it does religion no good to be separated from reality. And I'll say that again. It does government no good to rely on magical thinking, and it does religion no good to be separated from reality. There are many dimensions to fear. There's a huge belief in psychics, astrology, alien abductions, all sorts of funny and weird things nowadays. We used to call these things superstition. Many of them are relatively harmless, but I think there's something we need to think about in all these areas. Because, apparently, for many, the world does not make sense and is thus a bit unknown, or maybe even worse, unknowable. This makes people want to cling naively to all sorts of weird notions that give them emotional comfort and seem to make sense. The teabaggers are a perfect example. My plea is to use the power of our rational minds to understand the world. And for some reason, televangelists are unwilling to share God's email address with the rest of us. It doesn't sound like Christian charity to me. I mean, for people who claim to talk to God every day via telepathy or satellite, I'm having to put up with Comcast. But I do know that one-way tickets to heaven are frightfully expensive. I'm sure there are better bargains on the Internet. Well, it's refreshing to hear that our president now refers to Christians, Jews, Muslims, and non-believers. But it is disturbing that even now, some 85% of Americans say they would never consider voting for an atheist. 85%. From a democracy viewpoint, religious officials and promoters are not elected. They take no oath of office for the Constitution, and they do not have to account for their money. As I've said before, religious leaders have always tried to capture the power of government to promote their self-interest and their agendas. Well, I am confident. I think we the people is a beautiful and enduring idea. There is a viewpoint. No man or men can save this nation. It's time to put our trust in God or we perish. Or in another form, do we believe in the rule of God's law or the rule of man? I totally reject this idea. I think our Constitution reminds us to do like the delegates did in Philadelphia 227 years ago. They did not sit around waiting for prayers or scripture or rapture. The Constitution was made for we the people, not for deities. It is up to us humans to cherish and defend it. Various gods can fend for themselves quite well without help from us hairless apes. I'm a strong supporter of separation of church and state, and I think public displays of piety for political gains does an evil purpose in public and demeans religious values. Our loyalty and our patriotism has to be to our Constitution. But we do have to remember what we are up against. Televangelists bring in $350 million a year. Totally, churches bring in more than $1,000 million, more than $1 billion. Now consider the National Center for Science Education, which promotes the teaching of evolution in public schools. They scrape by on a mere $900,000. And the total membership of all the atheist and humanist organizations comes to less than 60,000. The entire Unitarian Universalist Association only numbers about 400,000. We all know how displays of religiosity are obnoxious. We all know that we want our children to grow up where government authorities are neutral about religion and religious viewpoints, without indoctrination and without favoritism. Secular means without regard to religion. It means doing good government independent of religious authorities. So is secularism a religion? Is non-belief a religion? The Catholic bishops maintain that these are competing religious views. We cannot let them get away with it. I do not agree with priests, preachers, televangelists having any moral authority whatsoever. Secular humanism is about humans, without regard for angels, heavens, hells, divinities, cherubim, seraphim, demons, satans, ayatollahs, popes, etc., etc. So let's be clear. Non-belief is not a religion. Not collecting stamps is not a hobby. Or as Bill Maher said it beautifully, abstinence is not a sex position. Although my friend Mike Newdow has argued that under God and the Pledge, sometimes you have to support the idea that atheism is required to be recognized under the Equal Protection Law. There are sometimes complications in legal arguments. So where do we stand in separation of church and state? 4 years ago, I was optimistic. I was saying that the religious right was waning, and we had a new era of secular humanism and democratic progressives coming. I recall saying this to my friend Rob Boston at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Lordy me, was I ever wrong. So the threats to the separation of church and state remain and are grave. For the first time in history, 6 of our 9 Supreme Court justices are Catholics. I don't think that Abington, Lemon, Engel, Weissman, McCollum, Roe, Griswold could ever be one in today's court. And there is a popular idiot, David Barton, who culls all the words of the founding fathers and pastes them together to make it seem like they were all faith believers, all in an effort to prove we are founded by Christianity. He is despicable. But now, whenever you read a quote on the internet about Washington, Madison, Jefferson, or Adams, you have to triple check where it came from. Well, there's much more I would like to say. The periods of religious fervor that swept our nation, the Great Awakenings, all had important influences on our understandings of separation of church and state. And there are these many new important understandings for our brains and the importance of messaging and narrative from the works of George Lakoff and a newly published book by John Haidt, The Righteous Mind. Here's an example. I think Obama's team allowed the Catholic bishops to define their case as religious freedom or religious liberty. It should have been framed as religious control and special treatment for religious employers. If non-discrimination is a valid public policy, then it is good for all and cannot be undermined by special interest. You know, as I look back on my life and the things I did and the things I did not do, I think of the beauty that I experienced in high mountains, with friends, with music, and with humanist thinking. I think separation of church and state is beautiful. Many of you may have heard the quote from Jeremy Raskin, a legislator in Maryland. I put my hand on the Bible and swore to uphold the Constitution. I did not put my hand on the Constitution and swear to uphold the Bible. So I'm going to conclude with 2 statements from the Supreme Court decisions. In Chemp, the court wrote, children are not noted for their resistance to the forces of social suasion. This reminds us that children in schools are vulnerable and need special protection. And in the Engel case, as I quoted earlier, it is no part of the business of government to be composing prayers. This reminds us to always ask, what is the business of government when you have city councils and school boards thinking about prayers? It is no part of the proper business of government or politicians to be promoting religion in any form. That is what separation of church and state means and what secularism means. Thank you very much. Thank you.